back, and there was his white Eldorado.
This is Donald Trump.
Donald, red interior, black top, with two slash marks, and he had a roll of black electrical tape. And
we have 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's kind of a pattern where the word was disgusting, but the fact that he didn't know who did it was also disgusting. The fact, when you go back to Serge Kovalevsky, the fact that he mocked that reporter was gross. The fact that the crowd yucked it up also. So I have to wonder what's in their hearts. You know, they obviously don't have a family member who has disabilities.
Fred Trump III is the nephew of former President Donald Trump, current presidential candidate. But Fred Trump is the author of a new memoir about his family. It's titled All in the Family, The Trumps and How We Got This Way. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO hosts will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, some Portland public school students are released early since their classes don't have AC.
The Oregon Republican Party tries to block libertarians from the ballot.
And the Portland City Council moves a police accountability approval vote to next week.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 6th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland public school students were released early today because their school buildings don't have AC. They were let out early on Thursday and Friday during an excessive heat warning issued by the National Weather Service in Oregon and Washington. Temperatures reached 95 degrees outside, and indoors, students couldn't get any relief. 15 of the PPS's school buildings have air conditioning will remain in session. But air conditioning has still not been installed in the remaining 66 PPS buildings, hence the early releases yesterday and today. It's not a new problem. Air conditioning in classrooms was one major issue in the Portland teacher strike last fall, though ultimately teachers didn't get their demands for AC met. Meanwhile, in Beaverton, there was a recent bond measure which provided funding to schools to install permanent AC. All but one school in the Beaverton School District will be in session through the excessive heat warning. Schools will return to session next week. The weather will cool off with a high of 82 on Monday.
Two fast-moving wildfires near Bend prompted Oregon Governor Tina Kotek to invoke the Emergency Conflagration Act. The Rail Ridge Fire and the Shoofly Fire have grown quickly since being sparked this week by lightning strikes. The Rail Ridge Fire in Grant and Cook counties has burned over 100,000 acres in the past 2 days. Hot, dry, and windy conditions have meant fires have covered a lot of ground with lots of fuel to burn. The Shoofly Fire is in Wheeler County, burning 24,000 acres so far. The Emergency Conflagration Act means that the state can add more resources for firefighters battling the blazes. It's been invoked 16 times already this year. Oregon State Fire Marshal Mariana Ruiz Temple says there isn't much relief expected in the forecast this weekend or early next week. Over 1 million acres have burned in Oregon so far this year.
The Oregon Republican Party is attempting to block libertarians from appearing on voter ballots this November. It filed a complaint with the Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, saying the Secretary of State's office broke election law by allowing Libertarian Party candidates onto the ballot. The Capital Chronicle obtained a copy of the party's complaint. It says the Libertarian Party didn't follow its own bylaws in how it nominated candidates, and that some of the candidates may not be qualified to run. A similar appeal to block libertarians was denied last month. State law does in some cases regulate how Democrats and Republicans qualify for the ballot, but not so much for smaller parties. For example, state law requires candidates from major political parties to be members for at least 180 days before they're nominated. The state GOP says the libertarians didn't follow their own bylaws in nominating and that some of their candidates may not be eligible. They complained that Dan Ballin, nominee for Oregon's 4th Congressional District, put a Lane County homeless encampment as his address. They say it's not enough to establish residency. Oregon Republicans may be concerned about libertarians garnering votes that might otherwise go toward Republican candidates in tight races.
On Wednesday afternoon this week, Portland City Council voted on an emergency ordinance to approve sweeping code language establishing a new police oversight system for the city. The vote came almost a week after federal judge Michael Simon approved the amendments to a settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice, amendments necessary to enable the new system to take effect under the settlement's requirements. However, despite approving the amendments as is, Judge Simon ruled that the implementation date should be delayed until January of next year, when the city will have a new form of government with a completely new city council. Following the ruling, Mayor Ted Wheeler released a statement expressing frustration with the judge, going as far as to compare the ruling to Senator Mitch McConnell blocking President Obama's Supreme Court nominees. Judge Simon's ruling came after multiple community members testified that the proposed code language represented a step back from the system proposed by the All-Volunteer Police Accountability Commission, or PAC. Former PAC member and current organizing director of Unite Oregon, Jay Amechi, testified before council on Wednesday. Amechi listed some of the biggest changes made by the city and the issues they raise for the future of police accountability.
This current code makes a mockery of the strong, transparent, and accountable system envisioned by voters. The lack of an appeals process for community members is a glaring gap. While officers are afforded multiple means of appealing disciplinary actions, the community is left without any meaningful recourse if a case is dismissed without a full investigation. Another deeply troubling issue is the removal of the requirement for the oversight system to conduct regular reviews and audits of its operations. This would have allowed for a systemic examination of incidents rather than just focusing on individual officers. Removing this capability is a major setback for addressing the root causes of misconduct. And the inclusion of law enforcement on the nominating committee is another deeply concerning element that undermines the body's legitimacy in the eyes of the public. The perception of undue influence is unavoidable when those who are meant to be held accountable are granted a direct role in shaping the very oversight mechanisms designed to scrutinize their actions. The community deserves an accountability process that is truly free from the conflicts of interest that have plagued the old system, and anything short of a truly independent and civilian-led accountability system will be seen as another empty promise, leading to yet more resentment and discord.
That was former Police Accountability Commission member Jay Amici speaking before City Council on Wednesday.
Council members themselves were also upset, but their frustration was directed at Simon's ruling. Here's Commissioner Rene Gonzalez speaking after voting no on the ordinance.
Unfortunately, we operate in a world where a federal judge repeatedly ignores principles of judicial restraint that regularly platforms and capitulates the most radical anti-police members of our community. Last week, that judge chose to interfere in this body, rightfully elected officials, good faith efforts to implement the system approved by voters.
Gonzalez's no vote meant the ordinance could not pass, since emergency measures require unanimous consensus. Commissioners Maps, Rubio, and Ryan all voted yes, while also expressing their displeasure with the delayed implementation of the system. Mayor Wheeler, speaking last, also voted no, but indicated he would vote yes if the ordinance could be reheard next week as a non-emergency measure. Under the settlement agreement, the city must pass the measure by September 19th, starting a one-year implementation timeline, a timeline that, Wheeler noted, has now lost 4 months due to the judge's decision. He and Assistant City Attorney Heidi Brown had a brief but complicated back and forth about whether the council even has the legal right to delay approval for another week.
I think it would be challenging for the judge to find us in contempt of court or in breach of the settlement agreement when he's already delaying it till January 2nd. So, I mean, from a practical perspective, I don't know that there's a violation. I think the United States would be disappointed in our not living up to what they probably expect was the terms of the settlement agreement. But that being said, the judge, they were not happy with the judge's decision last week either. So I don't know that there's any practical harm in your moving this to second reading next week.
The second reading is, for now, on the council agenda for Wednesday, September 11th in the morning session.
Donald Trump is promoting a government shutdown over false claims of non-citizens voting. Democrats say Project 2025 would harm the nation's most vulnerable public school students, and the Texas Attorney General has sued to shut down voter registration efforts. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Let's do this until March, and let's attach the SAVE Act. Let's keep spending frozen, and let's protect elections.
Texas Congressman Chip Roy urges his fellow House Republicans to attach legislation requiring voters prove their citizenship to a must-pass government spending bill. The government would shut down at the end of the month without a continuing resolution. But Democrats counter it's already illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections. And they argue the Senate won't accept a measure that would have the effect of suppressing the votes of marginal groups. Former President Donald Trump supports the legislation. He's repeated false claims that the Biden administration is bringing in migrants so they can vote illegally and throw the election.
I would shut down the government in a heartbeat if they don't get it, and if they don't get it in the bill. Now, if they don't get these bills, they should close it down, and Republicans should not approve it.
Not all Republicans want to risk a shutdown, saying it could jeopardize vulnerable incumbents. Congress resumes work next week. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is suing one of the state's largest urban counties to prevent it from mailing out thousands of voter registration forms. Bexar County commissioners say the goal is to boost voter participation in and around San Antonio. But Paxton says it's an attempt to register more Democrats and non-citizens. County Commissioner Rebecca K. Flores says registering voters is nonpartisan.
I am continuously talking to migrants, and none of them are trying to figure out how to vote illegally. They are concerned with getting food and clothes on their back.
Texas lacks automatic or online registration. Civil rights groups say it's become one of the states that makes it the hardest to vote. Tennessee currently ranks last in turnout, but advocates are working to register more voters. Dawn Sluckabear with Think Tennessee says while that doesn't automatically improve turnout, easy online registration can be a good first step, especially in rural counties.
even just messaging in those communities that, if you have a Tennessee driver's license and access to the internet, you can get registered without even, you know, having to go anywhere.
The ACLU of Michigan is suing a Kalamazoo County election official after he said he wouldn't certify the 2024 election if it's stolen from Trump. Robert Froman previously told the Detroit News he believes 2020 was stolen, which is why he ran for office. Public education advocates are raising alarms about Project 2025. The right-wing roadmap for a second Trump term would eliminate Head Start and the Department of Education. Former teacher and Connecticut Democratic Representative Jahana Hayes says the conservative movement to slash and privatize education puts the nation's most vulnerable students at risk.
There's language in Project 2025 to roll back federal feeding programs. Hungry kids do not learn.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, KBOO presents Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable with the people running to represent Portland. On this episode, mayoral candidate Darrell Kinsey Bay. Tonight's weather, an excessive heat warning is in effect until 8 p.m. The overnight low will be 64. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy but warm, with a daytime high of 86 degrees. Today in history, in 2018, the Supreme Court of India decriminalized all consensual sex among adults in private, making homosexuality legal in India. The quote of the day is from Scottish-American writer Francis Wright, who said, "Liberty means not the mere voting at elections, but the free and fearless exercise of the mental faculties and that self-possession which springs out of well-reasoned opinions and consistent practice."
A new university program in South Dakota offers training to healthcare workers on how to provide culturally sensitive treatment for Native Americans. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Indian University at Crazy Horse has a new program designed for targeted healthcare, namely culturally sensitive Native treatment. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
The Wechozani Health and Wellness Program aims to create a culturally competent healthcare worker in a career field that already lacks Indigenous representation. Jessica Fillmore is the university's outreach coordinator.
We have partnered again with Black Hills State University and Crazy Horse Memorial to come out with a new spring program, which is called the Wechozani Health and Wellness Certificate Program. Wechozani is actually the Lakota word for health and wellness, which is what the certificate program is all about. Some of the classes that we'll be offering are ethnobotany of the Northern Plains, Native food systems, as well as Native American public health.
Fillmore says this will be one of only a few programs of its kind in the entire country.
I definitely think that having the cultural sensitivity as well as knowledge of specific issues that face Indigenous communities is a really helpful skill set that we hope to provide students.
Angel Lee is director of the Indian University of North America. She says this class roster was a collaborative effort alongside Black Hills State University.
The goal is to provide a comprehensive course framework for students to earn a certificate that gives them an idea of the issues that face contemporary Native Americans in healthcare.
The 12-credit program begins in the spring 2025 semester, and the application is open through November 1st. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene at the Crazy Horse Memorial.
A Wisconsin school district is launching an Ojibwe language immersion program for kindergarten students this fall. As Danielle Kading reports, school officials have been working with the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa to support language revitalization efforts.
Around a dozen families had submitted papers to enroll their kids in the program prior to the beginning of the school year. Bayfield School District Administrator Beth Monidu-Mukwa-Papp says the district of roughly 420 students is unique because the vast majority of students are members of the tribe.
I can't understate how significant this is, not only for our community and our area, but for our children and their future.
Benisique Washington is the tribe's education division administrator. She says historic federal policies and Indian boarding schools forced many Native Americans to abandon their language and life ways.
Turning back to teaching our students through our language and our cultural lens, I think it will and it has had a very positive impact on our communities.
She says students will learn all the same subjects like reading and math in the Ojibwe language. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The Office of Army Cemetery says it's honoring the requests of family members and tribes to return home the remains of 11 Native American students from the Carlisle Indian School Cemetery in Pennsylvania. This week, the process to disinter the remains began. The students are from tribes in Montana, South Dakota, California, and Oklahoma. They died between 1880 and 1910 while attending the government-operated Carlisle Indian Industrial School. Families and tribes of the students are likely to travel to Carlisle during the process over the next few weeks to accept the remains. The event, Reconciliation Through Art, is expected to take place September 30th in Ontario, Canada. The day-long event is bringing together Indigenous artists, performers, and knowledge keepers from across the province. Organizers say it's an opportunity for visitors to celebrate and support Indigenous artists while also building relationships in the spirit of truth and reconciliation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Nebraska Supreme Court we'll hear three cases about one abortion rights ballot measure on Monday. Deborah Van Fleet reports.
In an unusual set of circumstances, the Nebraska Supreme Court will hear arguments in three lawsuits about the two abortion-related ballot initiatives, each of which had successful petition drives for the November ballot. The first two lawsuits ask the Nebraska Supreme Court to rule to keep Protect Our Rights, which would legalize abortions until fetal viability, off the ballot. They claim it violates the state's single-subject rule. The third was filed in response to these on behalf of 29 Nebraska physicians who support Protect Our Rights. Joshua Livingston is an attorney with the law firm Koenig Dunn, which filed this lawsuit. He says there are two types of access at stake.
These physicians spend their days working with Nebraska patients, and they understand what Nebraskans need and what Nebraskans are asking for. And over 200,000 Nebraskans signed this petition asking for their voice to be heard. So the goal is access to health care and access to the ballot.
Livingston maintains the only fair outcome would require both initiatives to remain on the ballot or both to be removed. The Protect Women and Children initiative would prohibit abortions after the first trimester. Since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, voters in six states have passed constitutional amendments to protect abortion. Livingston says their position is that the single subject rule would allow both initiatives to remain on the ballot.
What we're really seeing is that the opponents to the Protect Our Rights, the activist opponents to this, are scared of what the outcome is going to be. They're scared that if Nebraskans have the opportunity to expand abortion health care, they're going to vote in favor of that.
Livingston says Nebraska voters' right to be heard is really what's at stake here. He says they're hopeful the Nebraska Supreme Court will rule before the September 13th deadline for Nebraska ballots to be finalized. For Nebraska News Connection, I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
A new poll indicates strong support for protection of the West's greater sage grouse. The results come as the U.S. Bureau of Land Management considers a plan for improving conservation of the bird. BLM is reviewing public comments on its draft environmental impact statement for amending and strengthening sage-grouse protections. The agency has plenty of public support for this. A poll commissioned by the Pew Charitable Trusts found that 93% of people surveyed back the BLM's efforts to protect the bird and its habitat. Tyler Dungannon with Oregon Hunters Association says many support even greater protections.
In the western U.S., roughly 70% favored restricting some development of specific public lands to ensure long-term habitat protections for sage grouse.
The poll also found that nearly 60% of respondents say sage grouse conservation efforts boost economic development. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife data from 2019 says that hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing fueled $1.2 billion in spending in the state. Josh Collins is a retired landscape ecologist in Bend. He says there are positives to BLM's plans for conserving sage-grouse, including the expansion of areas of critical environmental concern for the bird, and the agency elevating conservation as one of its priorities on public lands. But he says there's also room for improvement, such as a focus on ensuring sage-grouse chicks have wildflowers to feed on in their first few weeks of life.
One of the things missing in the BLM report, and almost every other state or federal report concerning the sage-grouse, is a focus on the dietary needs of the chicks and the brood hens.
Collins adds that bringing back the sage-grouse means bringing back wildflowers in the region, which will benefit other species.
Young pronghorn benefit from that. They eat wildflowers. And, of course, the pygmy rabbit does. Many birds are feeding on the insects that are attracted by the wildflowers. So the wildflower is kind of a missing piece of the foundation of the ecological health for the whole system.
That was Josh Collins, a retired landscape ecologist from Bend.
Researchers are working diligently to breed cattle that are resistant to extreme temperatures. With more on the story, it's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On warm summer evenings across the U.S., you can glimpse the twinkling lights of fireflies. These magical insects are threatened by light pollution and habitat loss. But a new study adds another risk to that list, climate change.
Those factors, coupled with the effects of climate change, are probably going to be the 1-2 punch for many firefly populations.
DJ McNeil is an ecologist at the University of Kentucky. He and his colleagues studied the relationship between environmental conditions and firefly numbers using population data collected by volunteers. They found that climate change poses a big risk to many firefly populations. Firefly larvae typically rely on long, cold winters to hibernate, but winters are getting shorter and warmer. And in the spring and summer, the larvae like to scurry around in wet soil, hunting for soft prey like snails. But increasingly frequent droughts could kill both the larvae and their prey. McNeil says the many threats can build on each other.
We're seeing so many species experiencing the kind of death by a thousand cuts, and that seems to be true with fireflies as well.
So in some places, summer nights may lose their sparkle. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
It's 5:26 p.m., time for The Point Puzzle, a weekly radio puzzle focused on wordplay and logic. As Pearl Stark from KPOV Bend tells us, this week's edition has to do with heartbeats, Labor Day, and traffic.
It's time for the puzzle.
Baby, you can drive my car.
We're in the middle of a two-week challenge. When I was thinking about Labor Day weekend traffic, this puzzle occurred to me. If you're driving 60 miles per hour and your heart beats 60 times per minute, then counting 60 heartbeats gets you 1 mile. So if you drive 65 miles per hour and your heart beats 65 times per minute, will it be more or fewer beats to get to a mile? This puzzle might also wake your brain up for back-to-school season. So again, if you drive 60 miles an hour and your heart beats 60 times per minute, then counting 60 heartbeats gets you 1 mile. So if you drive 65 miles per hour and your heart beats 65 times per minute, will it be more or fewer beats to get to a mile? When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpoe.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of September 2nd. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 6th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman and Hannah Francis. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Deborah Van Fleet, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin and have a great weekend.